and we have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Welcome to Gay USA and Happy New Year. I'm Andy Hum.
I'm Ann Northrup. We have a very special show for you today. It's an hour devoted to bringing us up to date on HIV and AIDS issues with a very special panel.
Really distinguished panel. I mean, I'm looking forward to this discussion. We have with us Dr. Tony Urbina, who is the medical director at Mount Sinai Hospital, a long record of HIV, including the Presidential Commission on AIDS, state commissions, everything, research. Our associate producer, Bill Ballman, is here. He is a founding member of ACT UP New York, if you didn't know. And again, a long list of things. Ivy Arce is a long-term survivor of HIV and an activist who's been involved in many, many groups, including ACT UP, for a long time. And Jason Walker, who describes himself as a queer AIDS activist, was a long-time activist at Vocal New York. And welcome all.
Yeah, thank you. We're really honored to have you all here. And I want to start by just introducing you to our audience, particularly those of you who've been living with HIV for a long time. So I just want to go around first for the three of you, Jason, Ivy, and Bill, and bring us up to date. How's your health? How is living with HIV in 2019?
Yeah, so I've been living with the virus since probably fall 2007 is where I kind of calculated where I got where I contracted a virus. I was diagnosed in early 2008, so it's been about 11 years living with the virus. And today I'm living good. I'm living healthy. I still, you know, have challenges and struggles being 100% adherent, but I'm still undetectable. I'm doing really well. My health is pretty good.
Great.
There's still, like, challenges, but, you know, still here, still feeling healthy and strong.
We will get to the details. Ivy, how about you? How are you doing?
So I've been positive 30 years. And in the early 90s, I had full-blown AIDS. And these days, you know, I'm fine in health, but for the last 2 years, I'm supposed to change a regimen. I just can't seem to figure it out as I used to be able to do it in the 90s, where I had a lot more connection of going through what was in front of me.
But what does that mean about not being able to figure it out?
Well,
you can't get it in place in the right way or get access to stuff?
Well,
or what?
As you age, they're finding a lot of complications with the old regimens.
Right.
So there's concerns about liver damage and hep C activating just by being a long-term survivor. So I haven't been able to really negotiate that. And being able to digest the information as I used to. Before, it was so much more immediate because, like, the PW Health Group would invite the people that we needed to talk about and that were doing the studies. I'm supposed to talk to somebody in San Francisco that only does clinical trials and only has conversations with practitioners but not patients.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been a big barrier for me. As well as being a straight woman, I just don't have, like, we just don't have that relationship as the gay community has in terms of, like, mobilizing. And I just lost all that. And in the last decade, we've just been so much more spread out, the few that we've been positive for many years. We're very few together.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll get into that in a little more depth. Bill?
I was a founding member of ACT UP New York before I even knew I was positive. And then when I did get tested back in 87, found out I was positive, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm fighting for myself as well. So being a long-term survivor like you've been, it creates new challenges every day. It's not long-term survivors, people who are over 60 with HIV or live with HIV for 25, 30 years or so, we are a first generation of long-term of survivors of this disease. So we are learning every day what the complications are, because people with HIV age faster than the general population. It's estimated about 10 years faster aging process in people with HIV than the general population. And what that translates into actual medical needs and necessities and disabilities, you know, is something that is new, and we need better understanding of that. And I think having the show today, I hope hopefully we'll get that word out there.
But your particular health?
It's good days, bad days. It's like, you know, there are days that I meet challenges that, you know, where I get a lot done, and there are days when I just stay at home and watch TV, you know. And
I could say the same, but that's...
But the thing is, it becomes like a real part of a disability that you can't do the things that you want to do, and other days you can achieve. Like yesterday, I got my hair cut. You know, I went shopping. I went to the gym. I got a lot done. And one of the ways that I cope with that is I have a good friend, and we text every morning. What is your plan for today? You know, and he'll tell me his plan. I'll tell him my plan, and then later on the day we'll reconnect and compare whether we've achieved those goals or not. Mm-hmm. And that's just one little tip that makes things work for us.
So, Tony, you're a medical director, and you see a whole range of patients now.
Quite a range here.
Who are you seeing? How are they doing as a in general, or what?
So, I've been involved with patients living with HIV since 1992. So, started at the storied St. Vincent's. So, I've kind of seen the full spectrum from where, you know, young men dying of AIDS-related complications and OIs to, like, now my oldest patient is 92 years old.
Yes. Wow.
Okay. And he's doing great. But I think, as Bill was saying, you know, there are some, I think, people living with HIV age a little differently. But what we're seeing at Mount Sinai, so we currently see 11,000 patients living with HIV. I don't take care of them all myself.
11,000.
Wow, yeah. And then another 4,000 that are at risk for HIV that are on pre-exposure prophylaxis. Uh-huh. So we kind of see the whole gamut of patients, from the very young that are at risk for HIV, maybe have a lot of sexually transmitted infections or things like that, to newly diagnosed young gay men, also young women, and then again all the way up to that upper age. So I think people, it's so varied. That's why I do think, in addition to all these new therapies that have come up that have been able to get that viral load to undetectable, a lot of the still very important things are things like nutrition, you know, having close relationships, you know, not being isolated. You know, all of those things can help you age better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as Bill described in that brilliant idea about the buddy system, basically.
The old buddy system is gone that GMHC
used to do. Well, you've created your own.
Yeah.
And what do you find are the things that, you know, support you the most or help you through the day the most?
I think, honestly, like, for me at least, when I was diagnosed, I didn't know anything about HIV other than I had it. I didn't know about community. I didn't know about AIDS activism.
This was in Kentucky?
This was in Kentucky. And, like, growing up in D.C., like, we didn't have, like, a robust AIDS activist community in Washington, D.C., right?
Which, of course, is heartbreaking to those of us who've been doing the work for 40 years. Mm-hmm. How is it that an urban area, an at-risk area like mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., people could be ignorant, but people are ignorant today. People are ignorant all over
New York.
So continue.
So for me, what I find is just my community of AIDS activists, the folks that I do this work with, this organizing work, has been kind of like my greatest support system in just making sure that I can, like, survive, live, and thrive as a person living with HIV.
But how does it manifest itself on a daily basis? Are you in a situation where you don't really have to think about it? Are you on a treatment regimen that is easy?
I'm on a one-a-day. I am on Lord, I switched so many. they switch you really quickly these days. Before I started with Complera, Schreibild, and now I'm on something I cannot remember this time.
Biktarvy? Is it Biktarvy?
Biktarvy. Yeah.
Biktarvy?
It's
okay.
Biktarvy.
Okay.
Yes. They just recently switched me. But yeah. That goes to say, like, they're, because of how rapid and how quickly we're moving right now with HIV medicine, people are releasing, like, safer ones more quickly than before. Like, in my 11 years, I've already been on three different type of medications, all just because the latest one is more safer. Not because I've experienced any type of mutation or thought to be more safer. Not because I've experienced any mutations or any issues. It's just my doctor's like, hey, this is better for your bones or this is going to be better for your kidneys. So I'm on one a day. I think like my lifestyle makes it a little bit challenging for me to be adherent all the time. I'm just kind of like on the run, got a little ADHD going on. So like for me, it's like I keep my medicine with me everywhere I go. So when I remember, I take it as soon as I remember.
Okay.
And I found that that has been my approach instead of like getting caught up like I didn't take it at 8 a.m. or I didn't take it at lunch. I just keep it with me and make sure I take it at least one time during the day.
And you take it once a day?
Once a day.
Okay.
I think most everybody is once a day at this point.
Yeah,
right?
But now you have like to take, you know, Lipitor and all those other things, and for women, it's like devastating, I believe. And I'm like the opposite. I've had three regimens, but I held it till the last minute until they didn't work, you know. And I have like a huge barrier about changing to the new one. And I think that's for the old term survivors. There's a lot of baggage in that, you know, trying to like play chess games. And I don't even know if that's the correct way to look at things anymore.
Well, the thing is that, you know, we were so afraid that our long-term survivors that we would run out of options.
Exactly.
You know, we kept switching. So we stayed on drugs that were too toxic. And we stayed on the D drugs for too long, and that caused neuropathy. And if we had switched quicker, maybe we'd be better off, you know. And there are various other reasons why, like you said, you're afraid to switch, and then you build up a more of a long-term toxicity.
But there are a lot of options for people with AIDS, he says. And as you said, you're undetectable and these things. You know, we read this week that there's something like 154,000 people who haven't been tested who don't know it. I don't know how they exactly figured that out.
Exactly.
But what can we say to them to get people tested, and what do they face?
Yeah. I mean, I think nowadays there is no downside to getting tested and to having that information, because it can be life-saving. And the thing with HIV is that the sooner you can detect it, then the less time the HIV has to kind of penetrate deeper into your body, into what's called the reservoir. And the immune system is like an orchestra. So after years of untreated HIV infection, you kind of lose maybe the string section. So even after you start on treatment, if somebody's had untreated HIV for decades, you can start them on meds and they'll do well and they won't progress, but they're never going to do as well immunologically as someone that was like started on therapies early. And just another point about I think the future also looks very bright for people living with HIV. There's going to be long-acting injectables.
The vaccines we're talking about, either therapeutic.
No. This one is for treatment.
For
people living with HIV, and that's going to be available very soon.
So how often would you have to be administered?
The first wave is every 2 months.
Oh, I heard 6 months, but 2 months?
Yeah, we'll get to 6 months, but 2 months is better than worrying about whether you've taken a pill today, isn't it?
So, I think it's great that there's going to be a lot more options. There's going to be different devices, implantables, and things like that will offer drug delivery systems, maybe even up to a year. So I think it's just identifying people early, you know, starting them on treatments, you know, preserving their organs, their immune system, and then, you know, hopefully one day there will be a cure.
I remember vividly the debates 20 years ago about when to start treatment, and the really huge argument about do you wait because the treatments are so toxic that you don't want to be on them any longer than you have to be, or do you start early because then you can have a better outcome?
Yeah, I think the latter, and it's because the advances with the antivirals and the medications. And now what we do at Mount Sinai is we offer treatment the day of diagnosis.
Right. Yeah. Now, you talk about no downside to testing. But the downside to testing has always been fear of stigma.
Yeah.
That if, first of all, if you test, and you're positive, you suddenly become subject to criminal laws in this country that criminalize sex if you're HIV positive. Or you then become known as someone with HIV, and how does that affect your employment situation or your family situation or your friends? Right. So I wonder how you all are thinking about stigma these days. Right. I mean, is it easy to be out and casual about it, or is it something you still think about? What's the deal with that?
So for me, I think, like, I say assholes will always exist. So I think that, you know, so...
But you said that very quickly, but
yeah,
I caught it.
Yeah, I think, like, folks like that will always exist. But in my experience, I did have a fear about, like, talking about my status, being out with folks, talking about my with my family in particular. And I felt like I needed to do the education first, just like as an advocate on the outside, to just soften them up before I can get in, so that I can help do some of this destigmatizing work through education. That's kind of like how I kind of like manage this world of stigma.
So
it's like
classic.
I just did, you know, like educational piece, and then I will step in and be like, "But this is me." So now that you understand that I'm not this boogeyman kind of thing. It worked, but then it was a lot of work. So yeah. And I didn't feel like doing all that work. So that was more so in my interpersonal life. But in my more intimate life, with my partners and relationships, I realized that when I told folks about my status, what I fear didn't actually manifest. Like, I didn't actually lose the hookup, or I didn't actually like lose a person who cared about me. Those things didn't actually come into manifestation. And I do want to make a point about like how I think like we address and understand stigma. I think like oftentimes we put the burden on people living with HIV AIDS to do the anti-stigma work. It's like so many campaigns I see focus on people living with HIV AIDS about like not stigmatizing them. But I think like we need to really talk to folks who are perpetuators of stigma and be like, hey, what does it look like to see you on a PSA ad saying like, hey, this is what I learned about HIV and now I'm not this stigmatizing person. I think like oftentimes we place a lot of the anti-stigma work on people living with HIV AIDS. And I think like we should actually be like, hey, what does it look like to like have the people who are the perpetuators say I'm no longer perpetuating it. Mm-hmm. And like so folks can see themselves in that. And I think like oftentimes that's how I think like anti-stigma is really just still burdens people living with HIV to do the work.
No, you know,
just
think like, yeah. It's the same principle in bullying and,
exactly.
You know, shouldn't we be working with the bullies rather than just arming the people who are bullied?
Yeah.
Ivy, what are your thoughts about stigma and what's your experience of it?
Well, 30 years ago in New York, even though the epidemic was happening, I worked in an agency. And we had clients dying, a lot of people from fashion. And the people that owned the agency would go and do the eulogies. But as soon as I tested, in those days we had no protection because of everything was out in the open, they dragged me in front of everybody and said that if anybody tested positive, it would be my fault. And I don't know what it was, the issue of, they behaved completely different because I was a woman. I don't know what it was, because I saw them in funerals and, you know, long before I was even educated about it. And then the stigma clamped in immediately, from telling everybody in the agency without my consent, to the threat that I am this thing that could hurt other people, to asking for my period, not letting me go to the restroom.
Oh my goodness.
So how you overcome that in being an Asian woman is huge. My father just died this year, and none of my parents do know. There's no chance of educating them before I give them the news. I do that with my kids. I did this, you know, the educational part with my kids before I told them. And I think that if you go around the world, there's not a lot of Asian women that really can say I'm positive. I've been, you know, there's a sense of you're dirty. Women are already disposable thing in a lot of cultures. So therefore, you're damaged goods. That plays into a lot of things. And I had a lot of stigma also dealing within the HIV community. Like the HIV doctors never really treated me equally. And that was a long process. And, you know, it's sort of like, it's truly like choosing your battles and navigating that, because there was no other option.
Bill?
It's kind of like being gay. You know, you get on an airplane and, you know, you're thinking, you're long flight, you're traveling by yourself, and the person sitting next to you doesn't know anything about you. You don't know anything about them, but you wind up getting in a conversation. And, okay, you know, should I talk about my gay activism? Should I talk about my AIDS activism? Should I say the positive? It's like, you know, so it's always there as a coming out process,
yeah.
You know, with everybody you know. And fortunately, it's like my circle of friends and whatever. It doesn't really make much of a difference. But it's also something that you kind of sometimes even self-stigmatize yourself,
yeah.
You know, where you feel that, you know, okay, do I really belong here? I'm going to be in a group of friends who are, you assume maybe they're all negative, and it's like, you know, is it a party I want to go to? It's like, you know, is it a circle I want to be a part of? And so you sometimes surround yourself more with people who are also positive,
right,
for that reason. But, you know, it's a daily challenge. I think it plays a trip on your mind, yeah, on a daily basis.
Well, I mean, just go ahead quickly,
because I don't want to, like, to leave, like, saying that, like, it doesn't, like, really manifest and exist. When I was in Louisville, Kentucky, in particular, when my diagnosis, the place where I was receiving my HIV care, going there for, like, support, was the most stigmatizing place. It was, like, in a hospital, in the open. It had a cute name where you couldn't recognize it, but everybody there knew who was there. The people at the front desk were rude and disrespectful. I felt, like, abused just by the receptionist. Didn't make me want to go back again. And also, I want to say, like, in the world of kind of, like, these hookup apps and social media, like, you see a lot of those things in profiles. So there is this big perception of kind of like stigma, right? You see a lot of folks say, hey, I'm clean, or like, oh, no, mm-hmm, HIV, mm-hmm, must be clean in order to hook up.
I'm on PrEP, but I'm not going to be with someone who's positive.
Yeah, type thing. So, like, there is still kind of like, I want to say, like, this kind of like culture of stigma that folks with HIV could, like, perceive as, like, this is going to be, like, my reality. And I will say, like, more often than not, you're not going to experience that, even though, like, it's the ones that we'll see those and we'll recognize those a lot. We won't see the other ones who don't have those languages on their profiles. We'll recognize those, and those will stick with us. And then we'll navigate the world assuming everyone will see us that way.
I mean, back in the bad old days, I remember Catholic priests who had HIV would get up in the pulpit. They knew they were going to die, and they said, folks, this is what's going on with me. And, you know, because it was so fatal in those days.
Right.
But now it's changed. I mean, the Speaker of the City Council, Corey Johnson, knew he was HIV positive for 9 years before he went public about it.
Right.
He told his friends and his people close to him. So what is, I mean, and in a way, what's the reason for being totally publicly open? It's kind of brave to be, but since you have a manageable illness, why would you have to tell anybody?
Yeah, I think you can do whatever feels right for you, but I do think when there are public figures, like I think Magic Johnson did a lot,
yes,
to kind of destigmatize HIV, I wish we had other people, other celebrities maybe even, you know what I mean, or just that could disclose their status, because I think that would further help to destigmatize. But what I'm seeing in my practice is that I'm seeing less stigma, you know what I mean, especially in, like, younger patients. And they are, you know, hooking up now if they're negative with someone that's positive, and they're talking about, well, I am undetectable. And I think that whole U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. So the data shows that if a person living with HIV is on their meds, takes them, has an undetectable viral load that they cannot sexually transmit. Right. So that's I think very destigmatizing. And then also, you can have a child, right? So a serodiscordant couple, one's positive, these other is negative. You know, you can have a child free of HIV. So you can, you know, so you can. There's also conception and all these things. So much more, you know, lives that are very similar to people without HIV. But I do think more public figures getting out there and maybe disclosing or talking about it.
Got a rugby star in Wales. But somebody was going to expose him, so he said, yeah, I've got it. This was a couple of weeks ago.
That's the best we can do at the moment.
Well, he was big news in the United Kingdom.
In Wales, yeah.
In the whole United Kingdom. He was a beloved figure.
Because we're in New York, I think, is different.
I think,
or California. I don't think it's around the world, you know, people.
Well, you, in fact, have just traveled to Asia and had your eyes opened a little, even as someone very experienced in all this. Tell us about
your trip?
Well, I was asked to do some talks in Taiwan and Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, they had the longest survivor they had known in a lot of these groups was somebody that was positive for 11 years. And the room was all full of men. And the caseworkers were the women did work for sex trade women. Mm. So the answer is that we all died in silence, and we continue to die in silence overseas. And I believe that there's a gap of history now that is kind of dangerous, because in Taiwan, there, a lot of the activists were telling me that they were resentful that the U.S. was owning the process of PrEP, being in the public. And I said, well, who do you think did that work? And they said, well, you know, we heard there was somebody in Germany. And that was really, like, really heartbreaking for me, because that's work that a lot of us were very resentful to have to come back to do. But we want, you know, we had to do it, because in 2012, a lot of young people were infected, and, you know, it took a huge amount of science and advocacy to make this happen. So a lot of this does not work overseas, so they fall back into the medications that we take. So that was really heartbreaking for them not to know anything about ACT UP, to really think that prior to this one few people that lived 10 years, that there were no people in history there. And and then somebody in Taiwan said, actually, the HIV is not looked upon, I guess, gay illness anymore. But then he pulls out what is associated with hemophilia. And I just thought that is completely gap of history. I mean, this is really important to, now we're stigmatizing something that does not happen because blood is tested, and this is not happening. But young people around the world is 3 decades in not knowing that and not being able to be activists in a true sense, because I do believe that maybe that I sent you this email about looking outwards of what pharmaceuticals overseas can do. If other countries have broken patent, like in Brazil in the early days,
yes.
Therefore there might be a new model or ways of doing business unlike this. So when you were talking about what is the detriment about testing, one of them would be being long-term medicine and supporting this, you know, this kind of like business model that we no longer ask for a 1 or 6 month pill, but we're asking for you know, take it as you go. That's kind of like we accepted that. Mm-hmm. We have 1,000 drugs, but they're all this model.
Right. Well,
one of the things I was in Malaysia a couple of years ago for the International AIDS Conference and met a community of people with HIV there, and mostly in Kuala Lumpur, and there's one hospital in all of Malaysia where most everybody with HIV goes to. It's outside of Kuala Lumpur. And what was I found it very empowering to meet these people, because at the opening plenary, a person with AIDS spoke. And at the closing plenary, the final session of the meeting, a transgender person with HIV spoke and spoke out powerfully for their right to be able to work mm-hmm. and have jobs and to be treated with respect. And this is a country that has a Muslim government. Mm-hmm. It's about one-third population Muslim, one-third population Chinese, and another third population Indian. And the cultures don't really intersect that much. But I was really empowered by how the people that I met there, and I spent a lot of time talking with them, and I did some traveling around the country with them after the conference was over. And I was very happy to see their model for dealing with HIV and dealing with pushing forward. You know, and I remember at one point I spoke to the Minister of Health. He was at the cocktail party at reception after the opening plenary, and I went up to him and I told him things that they should be doing in Malaysia, and I was like, and the next day I was told by
Someone's like, I can't believe you spoke to the Minister of Health that way. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, that's like, I said, you know.
From New York.
Yeah.
It's Bill. That's how we talk.
Yeah. But they were instituting a new policy in terms of dealing with drug use and criminalization and putting people in prison for long periods of time. And I told them that that's good and they need to do more. But speaking truth to a Muslim government is not so easy.
But there's a lot of HIV people out there.
A lot.
Desperation, you know, as we say, if you're not guaranteed another day, you mobilize differently.
Yeah. And you mentioned transgender folks, and you know, this is a particularly vulnerable population, often homeless, on the street, etc. So you now have a center for...
Right, so we have a center for transgender medicine and surgery at Mount Sinai, and it's basically comprehensive medical and surgical care for persons with the trans experience, and so not just the hormones but also the gender affirming surgeries. So that's quite a robust program. But you are right. So in particular, trans black women and trans women of color have the highest risk for acquiring HIV.
Because
of, I think, a lot of issues. Some of them are those kind of like social determinants of health. So some of you said like maybe unstable housing, discrimination,
violence.
Lack of access to care.
Yeah. So all of those things are really this kind of like perfect storm.
So employment problems leave them doing sex work to survive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Puts them at risk.
Yeah. And the thing is that now they're the new meds, there's not really drug-drug interactions with the hormones and these new meds, so they can be safely combined. But I don't know if that information is available to all, you know, persons of trans experience. But I think hopefully...
How many people have been in the program? It seems like it's been very successful.
Yeah, so they do about 7 to 8 gender-affirming surgeries a week.
Wow.
So they range from the whole top surgeries, bottom surgeries. And I believe their population is, you know, in the thousands now. Yeah.
So you referred briefly earlier to new things coming along.
Yes.
Vaccines, therapeutics, whatever.
Yeah.
What do you see in the pipeline most imminently?
Right. So I think the next step is going to be these long-acting injectables, which will be available probably third quarter 2020. All right.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that's
exactly.
Yeah.
That's a year. That's good.
Right. And then there are these implantable devices that can go in almost like an explant or contraception, but they're going to...
Norplant. Yeah,
like a Norplant.
So these are therapeutics for people living with HIV.
Correct. And then I think for vaccines... I think there's also this new optimism. So there are 3 vaccine trials that are going on.
Yeah.
One of them, I think, has been fully enrolled. But I think we'll start to get data next year. And with a vaccine, you don't need to be like 100% effective. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be like measles or, you know, they kind of did the modeling to show if it's 50% effective, at least that can make a huge impact on a population level.
On a population level, but if I am deciding whether or not to use the vaccine, I'm one person, and if you tell me it's 50% effective, I'm not going to have a lot of confidence in that.
Right,
the more
right.
people that take it, the less likely you are to get
to encounter HIV.
Exactly.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. On an individual basis, then what does that mean? Does it mean that I forego condoms? No, right? I mean, you know what I mean? So you still want to...
But it's kind of like getting the flu shot. It's like...
I don't do that either.
The herd effect, right?
So it's a big difference between, like, you getting the flu shot, and that's going to give you some protection, and then you get the flu anyway, versus getting HIV.
While the flu can be deadly,
yes,
it doesn't feel like quite the same risk as HIV.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about
50% effective vaccine.
Right.
Let's talk about other... You know, we regularly, every week on this show, we're talking about these issues and have been reporting on it since the beginning of the epidemic. But What we hear now most commonly is huge explosion in sexually transmitted infections.
Yes, yes.
Because people are not using condoms. They are on PrEP, or they're undetectable or whatever. So what is your experience of that, and what's your advice about that?
Right, right. Great question. Okay.
You know, that is the classic guest statement to butter up the host. What a great question.
What a great question. And it gives me time to think, too.
Yes.
No, but I've thought about this, and I am seeing it in my practice.
Yeah,
I definitely am seeing it. There's more, you know, condomless sex. I mean, once people know that PrEP is near-perfect protection against HIV, but I say, don't let the enemy of the good, you know, be perfect.
Yeah.
You know, is that PrEP is something that, if taken correctly, can avert HIV. These other bacterial sexually transmitted infections we can treat. But I think it also opens the door to talk more about sexual health. How is it you're having sex? And to kind of have the patient and the provider have a more open discussion about sexual health and about the importance of getting screened for sexually transmitted infections. But I also am like cautionary with patients because, you know, rectal herpes isn't fun.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's painful and it's recurrent, and I've seen that.
And rectal cancers are something that aren't talked about enough.
Right. So that's why one of the things that we're seeing more also in our practice, too, is use of vaccines like HPV vaccinations.
Right.
Right. Which which I think is huge for both women and men.
Should be.
Yeah.
What are you encountering out there, Jason, on the dating scene among your peers?
Well.
Okay.
No, I mean, you know, with
what the lights.
Just tell them, great question.
The
you know, okay, so, in post, like, so I, you know, I used to, like, frequent, like, sex parties and do a lot of, like, hookups. And I think, like, for me, I use kind of, like, the same treatments that were used to, like, combat like gonorrhea and chlamydia, kind of like as a prep when I used to go into like before like sex parties. So like if I went to kind of like those type of scenes or environments, I would use kind of like I would take a couple of those pills as a way to make sure that I don't contract.
An antibiotic?
Yes, I would take like I'm allergic to penicillin, so my treatments are just like it's a lot. So I would take like azithromycin or something else that starts with a D I can't think of right now.
Doxycycline.
And I would take those, like, let's say I plan on going to a party on Saturday. I would take it on a Friday and Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
And the attitudes and among your
peers.
You're
quite the party guy.
I was.
And the attitudes yeah. among but, yeah. but the people you encounter and their attitudes towards all this and safety and general safety.
Like, I think, like, generally, like, I think, like, because sex, I think, like, sex has always been very accessible, but now you don't have to go anywhere. It's delivered, right?
Right.
It's like, you could, like,
yeah.
it's, you know, kind of like, it's Uber to you, literally. So like, sex is much more accessible in ways where folks don't have to go to kind of, like bathhouses, like, things.
Right.
So, like, folks can just find someone in their nearby proximity, don't have to leave their house and just go those ways. It just makes it, I think,
the
like,
doctor is confirming your experience.
I'm also saying so you don't have to buy anybody a drink anymore.
Yeah, no.
Jason,
just send them a pic.
We did used to meet each other on the street just passing each other.
But like I think like that doesn't
stare,
really happen. It's so easy just to be sitting in your bed and just like, hey, you want to come over? It's so much easier, right? And I think like folks would do that, yeah.
I just think that, yeah, that whole kind of like social platform has just changed the way people connect and just the availability of just swiping and the sheer volume and that, I mean, I think it's changed the brain, right?
Yeah,
as a mother, it freaks me out.
And what do you tell your children?
You know.
How old are your children?
I have a 19-year-old and a 15-year-old.
Scary
stuff. It's tough because they, you know, even though they're in New York City, they know my life, they know my friends and my community. There is a huge gap. They don't really understand the gravity of it. So what's like overseas, I mean, it's just, there's no registration. I'm very fearful. I'm very fearful of just their, you know, like porn comes in like you never have imagined before. It's just immediate, you know, it's in your house, you know. There's no need to save for that one magazine anymore.
Maybe if you can keep them at home with the porn, they'll be safer.
That's what they say. They're out of home now, but one is in college. Yeah, so, I spoke 3 weeks ago at Bernard
70 to 75 women, none of them took PrEP. Only five of them knew. And this is New York City.
So who is taking PrEP?
My experience with women is most women that take PrEP are because they're with a man that is positive. I've yet to meet a woman that is just a straight woman that just said, I knew about PrEP and I decided to take it. And actually, what is really interesting, I have a lot of friends my age that are coming down with all this other disease, but they'll test for HIV, but they won't test for the other stuff. So I have a whole bunch of friends that have had syphilis and all this stuff, you know, and I find that really interesting.
Tony, what would you recommend for testing protocols? How often should people test for HIV or for sexually transmitted infections?
Yeah, I think for HIV, I mean, what like the CDC guidelines are, you know, at least once during your lifetime. And then I think for people that are for people that are, you know, sexually active, stuff like that, annually, I think it's just a good way to do it, okay? I mean, and then for sexually transmitted infections, I mean, for gay men, we check every 3 months. And the thing is that you got to do what's called three-site testing. So it's not just a urine and blood. But, for example, if someone has gonorrhea of the throat, you got to swab the throat. Mm-hmm. Or if someone has chlamydia in the anus, you got to swab the anus. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, those infections in the throat and the anus don't have symptoms. But you can still have the infection, and then that makes you more susceptible to HIV as well.
And you can transmit those things,
Too. And you can transmit those things, too. So it's really tailored to the individual. And I do think that, I mean, looking at newer models, I think, you know, having to always go to the doctor, I think, you know, home testing or different platforms, we should start looking at those things to make it a little bit less onerous for persons to do that. Because I don't think really people want to go to their doctors every 3 months, admit all of this activity and stuff like that. So I think ways that we can make it a little easier for patients would be great, too.
But I think for younger people, it's like if they know that they're going through a period of hypersexuality, that maybe they should be testing more often.
Yeah.
Now, we're all activists here in one form or another, right?
Yes.
So what are we pressing for now on the HIV-AIDS front? What's the cutting edge of activism these days?
Jason?
I think this is a regional question, right? So I think, like, if we think of, like, nationally, I think, like, and it's also a community question because different communities have different access. But I think, like, low-income African-American communities, particularly those in the geographic South, they're still fighting for treatment access. I think, like, treatment access to ensure treatment access and making sure folks get tested, I think, is a significant barrier. I think, like, there's fights around that still. And making sure that PrEP is accessible and affordable in this country is a big, major fight that you're seeing a lot of AIDS activists from Peter Staley's lawsuit with Gilead to even the United States federal government suing Gilead.
And, shocking, right?
Yeah, very shocking. The Trump administration is doing good yet. And what PrEP for, and kind of like this new wave of AIDS activism, kind of like pioneered by like the PrEP for All crew, who is really about making sure we can have robust access to prevention to make sure we can help drive a nail kind of like in the coffin of this epidemic. So there's that kind of like stuff on a national level. But I think like also locally in the city and the state of New York, it's around just making sure we have good wraparound services for low-income folks them with HIV.
Yes.
We saw like major breakthrough in kind of like the milestone with the Department of Health with the cities in the epidemic plan. But on the state level, we're still experiencing challenges. Right. We're still experiencing low-income folks living with HIV AIDS, not having affordable housing protection like we have in New York City through our HASA, the HIV AIDS Services Administration program. So I think like we're really working on making sure that some of the most vulnerable marginalized communities have access to treatment care and also the resources to help mitigate those social determinants as a health, like employment, job access, housing, treatment access, and making sure the most vulnerable communities, like trans women in particular, sex worker, drug users, are not forgotten when we just prioritize kind of like queer folks.
It has driven me crazy for years that we don't do more outreach to inform people about the facts of the epidemic, get them into testing, get them into treatment. You know, I go speak in schools sometimes, and the ignorance level in these days is enormous because we've sort of forgotten about it.
Even though there is still on the books a requirement that they teach 6 AIDS lessons a year in classrooms. And is anybody following up and making sure that that's happening?
No. It happens once a year. Huh? It happens once a year.
So what's your advice on how best to outreach to underserved communities to convince people that they should be tested and that treatment is available? How do we reach people in a convincing way that doesn't go right over their heads or that they ignore or whatever?
So I think for me, it's about ensuring that we have infrastructure placed in those communities who we say are hard to reach, right? I think like what happens if what I've seen is like we try to deliver like services there or like send outreach folks into those communities. But I think like what these communities need is actually healthcare infrastructures, mm-hmm. robust healthcare infrastructures there that are comprehensive to the needs of the entire community, not just an HIV spot, right? I think it needs to be comprehensive to the health disparities found in those communities, because those communities who are like, particularly let's say like a low income community or like the poorest zip codes in New York City are also the highest rates of HIV. I'm sure they're probably going to be the highest rates of diabetes. I'm sure they're probably going to be the highest rates of like high blood pressure. I'm sure they're going to be those higher rates as well. So it's like, how do we create healthcare infrastructures there that are going to be fully comprehensive, that are like also have community engagement initiatives to make health and wellness a part of the community and not seen as like, hey, we're coming in to help or do things, but this is a part of actually what it means to be in community.
Indigenous.
And I think like, I think like just having that be a part of the lifestyle, what it means to be a vibrant community needs to be there. And I think like oftentimes we look at those places as being like vectors of diseases, so we come in there kind of like, hey, we're trying to like clean some things up. And it's really a top-down kind of thing. But if you can like integrate something from a bottom-up standpoint and make the community feel like, hey, this is a part of our wellness and well-being as a community, I think that's a really revolutionary model how we look at like low-income folks, and particularly communities of color.
And yet here and around the country, we're losing hospitals all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's insane.
For
I mean,
developers,
Vincent's
for
in New York,
for real estate,
you know. But I mean, around the country, these rural hospitals having to close down, et cetera.
Well, are these neighborhood clinics, these walk-in clinics, are they a good answer for any of this?
I mean, I think walk-in or urgent care clinics.
Yes.
You know, those I think are kind of one-stop shops. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I think you need a more comprehensive model, just like Jason said, that's in sync with the community, and you know, health. Should be a right. It's a human right. You know what I mean? It shouldn't be for profit.
It's a familiar slogan.
But
fulfilled.
Yeah.
Right. But one of the things you want to do is for people who are positive, you want to keep people in care. Because people fall out of care. They stop taking their meds. They lose hope. You know, so one of my big things is like when St. Vincent's closed, the HIV clinic of St. Vincent's was one of the only profitable centers of the entire hospital.
Because we got higher reimbursement rates.
Right.
What
the Consumer Advisory Board, people with HIV at the HIV clinic of St. Vincent's, what we did with the medical director then, Barbara Johnson, was shop that clinic around to the various other hospitals in New York, to NYU, to Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai eventually took over the practice,
right.
Lock, stock, and barrel.
Right.
You know, the location, and then moved it to another location, but kept all the doctors in place, kept all the nurses in place, the social workers, even the registrars, and the patient population. And one of the things that the patients did at St. Vincent's through the Consumer Advisory Board was make sure that people didn't fall out of care in that process, in that turnover. So one of the things I would suggest people as activists do is get involved with their local hospitals and their clinics and serve on community advisory boards, because most of these institutions have to have them by law. And some of them are just paper tigers, or they're just they have them and they don't really do anything. The one at Mount Sinai, we stress over the lack of a coat hook on an exam door, you know, the water fountain working, to someone being snippy at the registration desk and not treating a trans person with respect.
Yeah.
You know, all of those things we do and we work on a daily basis as a Consumer Advisory Board. I think that's very important for everybody to get involved and not say, well, it's terrible that these things are going on. You know, roll up your sleeves and figure out what the process is about fixing those problems.
Yeah. I think also that moment of, like, our our powers of consumerism at that point was very different, where we would be in this places where we can negotiate that, because we're, you know, we had this virus that was could endanger anybody. So we had a different voice that people could hear us, and today's no longer like that. I remember waiting for Barbara for like 8 hours, you know, when that call transited. And it was like really intense to go through those transitions and not being able to find doctors. I find that like a lot of the doctors I see are like 30 years younger than I am, that never has seen CMV. So one of the things that we worked on, and I don't know if it's still in place, at the Planning Council during Giuliani, was we put the special network, which was not just bringing into the community, but to incentivize all different forms of medicine to be updated in HIV, so that the eye doctor would see these things, that in gynecology, which in the real world we don't have that even till this day. So incentivizing how they get certified and be still interested, like in my OBGYN, even though I had seen her for 15 years, the moment I got pregnant, she said, I have nobody to refer you, and I can't treat you. This is in New York City in 1990, right?
Is that legal?
And that's not legal, but, you know, there's, you know, we, being in court is another life of activism, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's incentivizing the medical people to be woke, you know, in terms of like there's all these other diseases happening. There's four generations of women that have never felt that this touched their lives.
Right.
We did an action this year at Cosmo by ACT UP, so they would write about it. I don't know why, because I think that an ACT UP had decided that women get advice from Cosmo or the healthcare, which is devastating, right? And they won't write about HIV.
That was a current demonstration?
Yeah,
we were there 30 years ago.
It was for the anniversary, actually.
We love anniversary demos.
And then the way they did it, it's like the people that went into work just don't think this affects them at all. And I understand that.
We're getting down to about our last 7 minutes. We have a general audience here. People are from all, you know, coming at this from all perspectives, want to learn about it. People are concerned. What else do you want them to know before we finish this discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing, I think Jason really kind of summarized a lot of the, I think...
Beautifully.
Yeah, beautifully, the activism now. And I just kind of wanted to take the other end just about, you know, is like the long-term survivors. So, you know, those patients that were diagnosed in the 80s and, you know, living with HIV and surfing with that virus, you age differently. You know what I mean? So what we're seeing now, we're just starting to see a lot more frailty, you know, starting to see more neurocognitive issues. A lot more comorbidities and damage of the end organs and things like that. So I think it's something that we need a lot more activism, both in science and in research. So how can we address these symptoms beyond just getting the virus to undetectable?
Isn't there some statistic that people living with HIV, half of them are over 50 now?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Even in Africa, people with HIV are over 50.
Right. And just the amount, like, of polypharmacy and the number of medications that they're on, because in addition to their HIV, which you have to treat, their you know, diabetes and hypertension and heart disease and heart failure and all of these medications. So, I mean, I'm seeing that with my patients. I just see that they are aging differently. And just another thing is that I think we all want to extend life, right? We all want to live very healthily with HIV. But I also think it's...
To some extent.
But I also think it's important, how do we want to die, too?
Yeah.
And it's important that we start having these conversations with all of our aging patients. So let's just talk about what you want to happen in the event that, you know, you should have a pneumonia and something happens. So how do you want to die? What's the quality that you want, you know, for your, you know, last years? I think that's important as well. And as a society, I think being less fearful about
that's a question for everybody to get your documents in order about what you want towards at the end of your life, no matter whether you have HIV or not.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
But I remember in the early days of the epidemic, you were taking a million pills a day. And now you can treat HIV with one pill a day, but people who are older with HIV and long-term survivors, the pill burden has gone back up to what it was a long time ago.
Lipitor
I mean, you could be on a dozen pills a day for other things other than HIV. But I think the important thing is to, you know, I hated consciousness-raising groups when I was younger, but now I like going to a senior group and talking with other people about what we're facing, because you realize I'm not the only one with this problem, you know. I think it's important that people return to the passions they had in life when they were younger, join a low-cost gym to get out and do walking, maybe get yourself a dog, you know, so you're out of the house. Go to a demonstration and realize that you have vital years ahead of you and you're doing things that you believe are important. I think that's essential for a better life and also dealing with HIV better.
Ivy, you have thoughts on this?
I never stayed and worked for pay related to HIV. And that was partly because I had that traumatic experience of losing work in the early days. So I'm on the other side now, and I feel like the relevance maybe is to go back in it. Because for my situation, it's like, you know, I'm hoping that we don't lose sight of the economics of finding a cure and what it means for us, because we have all these other things that are at play. And it deals with a lot of, like, you know, human condition, you know, having sex and all those things that, for the most part, we can't control. You know, we talk about undetectable, but that's kind of, I have a lot of questions whether that's sustainable economically, distribution-wise, with the opiate. That's going to really change. Cultural-wise, around the world, that's a really hard thing to do unless the white people come and dump a lot of money for whatever reasons to control that. But when they don't want to do that, then this looks very different, right? We had the epidemic breakout in Indiana. It can happen in a dime, and we keep on pumping all this new medications, which I'm extremely grateful. But I just feel like that is, we're forgetting that we need to have a cure, and that's a really hard conversation. You feel almost embarrassed to bring it back up.
Thank you for bringing it back up. It's a very important conversation.
I think, like, for me, I want to, like, just, like, focus on kind of, like, young folks and youth, because I think, like, I contracted HIV when I was 20, diagnosed when I was 21. I know a lot of folks in particular contract HIV probably like in their early 20s, particularly in my community. I've lost a partner. He was 25 years old to HIV about 4 years ago. And about several years ago, I lost somebody else who was 28 years old to HIV. So still in, like, there is still a real live, like, issue with folks dying of HIV, particularly from, like, low-income communities, and both of them were, one was in Kentucky, one was in Georgia, respectively. So these are, like, folks who are dying, young, queer, African-American folks, particularly in the geographic South. So I wanted to just, like, you know, name that, like, hey, we still, like, living in a crisis, and young folks are really doing
Well, great. Now you've programmed our part two of this conversation by bringing these topics up. But we are in our last 30 seconds, so I just want to really thank you all for being here. I'm very grateful for your participation. I know our audience will be extremely happy to have heard you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank everybody in the audience for watching and staying with this discussion. And share it with your friends. It's online at gayusatv.org, and you can spread it around.
So thank you all.
Thank you.
Best of luck
thank
to all you. Of you. Bill, we'll see you here on a weekly basis. And that is the end of Gay USA for this week. We'll see you all next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.